Well, it's in there, you know.
Members, the chair will call the House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform to order. I apologize for delaying. We had a few little minor snafus and motions, and so we're trying to get this right. We're going to have to take action on the today on the motion by which we move House File 418 forward. And we also want to correct the minutes, or actually we want to adopt the minutes from that meeting. Now, that the minutes in that meeting will have the wrong motion in it, members, but it is an actual depiction of our actions then. So my suggestion is, or my preference would be that we just adopt the minutes, and then afterwards we make the motion to reconsider House File 418 so that we can then have the correct motion in moving that forward. So with that, I'm going to call on Chairman Constantine.
Mr. Chair, would you like them together or independently? We have the minutes from January 30th and the minutes from January 31st.
We can adopt both of them.
Move to adopt both of them.
Representative Constantine, so moves?
So move.
Very well. Discussion? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Motion prevails. So we have the minutes from, give me the dates again, the 30th and the 31st adopted. Now, members, the chair wants to, so this is going to be a two-part motion. The chair moves to reconsider the vote by which House File 418 was referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And if you remember, members, we had with a recommendation for re-referral to government operations. And so my intent is to reconsider that vote and then make a clean vote of referring House File 418 to Ways and Means. So the first motion before us is to reconsider that vote.
So moved.
Thank you. Representative Dean, so moves. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. So am I moving this?
Yes.
That's okay for me to move. So the chair now moves to refer House File 418 to Ways and Means. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, thank you. I appreciate your indulgence and patience with the chair. With that, members, today we're going to hear we're going to have a couple of presentations as well as consider House File 301. And the first presentation is going to be, I think, a important and a very insightful presentation from Director Todd. I have the last name, Director Miller. I'm like, well, let me try the first name correct. From Director Todd Miller of Mankato, who is Mankato Public Safety Director. Members, this is in keeping with the chair's desire, and hopefully the full committee's desire, to center ourselves as a committee and the work that we do throughout this session on this concept of community-centered public safety. As I shared earlier, the idea here is for us to use a lens by which we're making good, sound public safety, criminal justice reform decisions that are holistic in scope, meaning that it absolutely involves our law enforcement professionals and jurisdictions, and involves the broader community in keeping, growing, maintaining our public safety in the state of Minnesota. In my mind, you know, that involves making some very tough decisions, no doubt, about holding folks strongly accountable for misdeeds and for damaging community. As well as rethinking how we've approached certain behaviors that probably perhaps better suited to be thought of as behaviors that fall short of criminal activity and really reflect actions that are driven by antisocial behaviors, which in turn are driven by things like addiction and other maladies in individuals' lives. The idea, members, is to continually hold everyone accountable, but to do it in an appropriate way where we're mending community and where we're not using one size fits all in terms of approaching the work that we do with a strong incarceration bent. And so, again, the filter for me is to constantly ask ourselves how we're building strong communities and healthy communities. And with that, everything's on the table. You know, whether it's making sure that really bad behavior, you know, produces a strong punishment, or whether other behaviors produce an opportunity to still hold people accountable, but to do so in such a way where they're able to become healthy contributors to our Minnesota community. And so with that, I've asked Director Miller from Mankato to come and share with us his thoughts and his life experience in applying community policing. Mr. Miller, Director Miller, has an extensive background both here locally but also nationally and internationally, and I think has some really important concepts to share with us today. So thank you, Director Miller, for making the drive up from Mankato today.
Certainly. Roads are a little slick, but
yeah, I would imagine so. please state your name for the record and give us your testimony, and then hopefully we'll have some good time for question and answering it as well. Director Miller.
Sure. My name is Todd Miller. I'm the Director of Public Safety for the City of Mankato. And Chairman I and members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to come today to talk to you about community safety and something that I've been very passionate about throughout my entire career, which is, you'll hear it probably a little bit longer than maybe it should have been, but it's this is something I've been involved in, very passionate about. This is something that it goes to what you're talking about, and that is it's community policing. There's two parts of that, the police and the community. And I will use throughout the presentation community policing and community governance because it really needs to go beyond the police. It has to include every level of government if you're going to truly address the issues that impact our communities today. So I will use community governance because it's not just for the police. When we implemented this in Mankato, when I moved there in 2010, this is part of a 24-hour training course that we put on that included our mayor, council, city managers, every member of public safety, every department head in the city, every key supervisor, members of our Hispanic community, our Sudanese community, our Somali community, our higher education community, our local education community, and our business community. We all sat together for 24 hours and worked this basis, and I really think that's what you do. But I'm not going to spend 24 hours today. I've tried to cut it down. I want to give you an idea of what community policing, community governance is, maybe some of the issues that need to be or could be addressed, and then some examples, some award-winning examples of how it works for every type of incident, crime, community problem. Said, I've been a chief of police since 1976 in four different states, in eight different departments. I was chair of the IACP, Community Policing Committee, for almost 9 years. The only chief in the country that's a two-time award winner for the IACP and Cisco Community Policing Award. I won in 1999. In White Bear, my department in White Bear Lake, and in 2013, the Department of Public Safety in Mankato. I've been an instructor, consultant, speaker on community policing, community governance issues. I've been at the every place from the United Arab Emirates to Israel to Canada to the Caribbean to all over the United States. And I'm also a principal in the policing leadership group, and we try to build trust. That's kind of something I'll be doing, I hope, long past my formal public safety career.
Director Miller, just a quick interruption. Perhaps you can share with the members what IACP stands for.
Oh, IACP is the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the largest organization of police executives in the world.
Thank you.
So when we talk about community responsibility for what happens, whose job is it? whose job is solving crime, preventing crime, and maintaining or enhancing the quality of life. I would propose to you that this is a shared responsibility. What did we do for years as police? We just went and told our community and our councils to give us more money, to give us more officers, and then stand back and let us do our job. Well, that didn't work. By doing this, we took ownership of the crime problem. When I go out to a community meeting or I go to a training session, we talk about crime. Whose problem is it? Crime is not a police problem. And people say, whoa, what do you mean? Crime is not a police problem. It is a community problem. So what are we talking about when we go to talk about community policing or community governance? You got to know what traditional policing is in order to know where what it is to where you're going to. So traditional policing is incident driven. It's reacting to individual events. We get called, we go. There's no prevention involved. It's evoking the criminal justice process. And what's that mean? What that means is the typical way to solve a problem is to arrest. Well, there's a lot of people who need to be arrested, but that's not the best way to solve problems in a lot of areas. And using aggregate crime stats to evaluate performance by saying, oh, well, crime went down, so we must be doing a good job. The problem exists because less than half the crime is reported. So the crime stats don't really tell you a lot. The strategies that are used in traditional policing, quote, preventative patrol, driving through, rapid response, follow-up investigations, adding more police to the problem, and let's do a crackdown when we identify maybe there is a problem. There's a lot of studies that I won't go into, going back from the Kansas City experiment in the 70s, that show that preventative patrol and rapid response don't really work. They don't make an impact on the level of crime in a community. So, breezing through, what does work? Community-oriented governance, which is based on community-oriented policing and problem-solving. So you will hear COPS, which is community-oriented policing, COP or COPS, community-oriented policing and problem-solving because they're intertwined, and then community-oriented governance. I'm going to use a definition for you that comes from a colleague of mine, Dr. Robert Friedman, that was the first definition of the official definition of community policing. And I bring it up because not only is it a great definition, not only is Dr. Friedman a good close friend of mine, but he's also got most of his education at the University of Minnesota. So what's COP defined? He is currently the chair of the Criminal Justice Department at Georgia State University, but he defined this. Community policing is a policy and strategy aimed at achieving more effective and efficient crime control, reduced fear of crime, improved quality of life, improved police services and police legitimacy through a proactive reliance on community resources that seek to change crime-causing conditions. It assumes the need for greater accountability of police, greater public share in decision-making, and greater concern for civil rights and liberties. Does that sound like something that we want to support, that we want law enforcement in our country to be? I think the answer to that is yes. We go way back, Sir Robert Peel. This was the first, he came up with Peel's principles of modern policing, and they're still very important and they meet today's demands as well. Sir Robert Peel came up with his 10 principles when he founded the London Regional Police in 1829. And number 7 of those Peel's principles is the police are the public and the public are the police. The police are only those who are paid full time, those citizens who are paid full time to give attention to the duties that are incumbent on every citizen in the interest of community safety. So that means crime control, community safety is everyone's responsibility, not just those who are getting paid to do it. So what are the core components of community governance? Well, one, building community partnerships as a force multiplier. We will never have enough police. In government, we cannot afford enough police to make this, to make truly an effort, and we don't want to have that many police. It includes, those partnerships include citizens and other government agencies, and that's where the community governance comes in. Problem solving. That's a proactive strategy for reducing crime and disorder. And if you're going to address issues, you've got to work on solving problems. It's organizational transformation to support those new strategies. Officers have to have the ability to make the decisions closest to the problem, which is on the street, working in the neighborhoods. In Mankato, we have officers assigned to every neighborhood, 1,000 to 2,000 residents in each neighborhood, and we have officers assigned to each one of them. They're supposed to get to know those people, to know what their problems are, to meet with them on a regular basis, and then to work with them to solve those problems. And then lastly, it's community outreach and trust building. We can't have law enforcement in the United States without trust. And I think we see in the United States there is currently a lot of lack of trust within the police mission. And this philosophy aims to address that. So community governance, it's a philosophical approach to local governance. No community, no two communities are the same. And in fact, many neighborhoods in the same community are different. It seeks to help cities better coordinate their service delivery and collaboratively solve community problems along with citizen and community-based groups. All these problems and calls for service come into law enforcement because they're there 24 hours a day. You call 911 and we respond. But the problems that you call, most of them are not crime-related problems. They are quality of life issues. They might deal with public works. They might deal with zoning. It doesn't matter. Those problems come in, and there are other departments within a city that are better equipped to solve those. Community governance focuses on governance as a process rather than government as an institution. Government should not be the focus. It should be how we govern our communities and ourselves. And it relies on municipal agencies to engage each other, to work together and with their community to address community problems, improve quality of life, increase citizen satisfaction, and plan for the future. That's why we do it. So community governance, each segment of local government has different resources, expertise, and perspectives that can be brought to these jurisdiction-wide issues. It's a matter of coordinating those efforts and making them seamless to the public, developing more effective responses that add greater value to the public service being provided. I think that's why government exists, is to provide that public service to our communities and to our citizens, but we can only do it working together and working with them. So what does COG do? It recognizes that activities of one city department affect the other departments. What we do as police might impact parks, might impact community development. It provides a holistic approach to local government service delivery that breaks down organizational barriers. My police officers regularly speak to parks workers, street department workers, engineers, community development. It encourages community and municipal stakeholders to pool their expertise and limited resources to address community problems. If we can be more efficient at solving community problems, that can impact the tax dollars that are focused on this. And if we're going to keep at the same level of tax dollars, then there's more money to be able to do other things to address other problems. And it provides a voice for a full range of community stakeholders and input into that decision-making process. We can't solve community problems without input from the community, and that's what COG allows us to do. It engages community members in their own well-being for an improving the community's quality of life. It adheres to the democratic principles of equality and responsiveness. It increases transparency and accountability. And that is one thing we hear whenever there's an issue, whenever there's a problem. Are you transparent? Is government being transparent? Well, this is the focus of community governance. It shares the responsibility for community safety and quality of life between local government and the community because we all own the problem. And it stresses community well-being outcomes, i.e. the health and the safety, rather than mere outputs. We don't want to look at just the number of tickets written. And there's a lot of analogy, a lot of research been done into the community policing, community governance philosophy, and the medical philosophy. As a doctor, sometimes doctors have to do negative things for the overall health of the patient. So we may have to do surgery, we may have to remove an organ, we may have to do something that is essentially a negative approach. But it is something that is necessary for the overall health and safety. Well, police have to do that too. And sometimes that means an arrest, taking a parent or a loved one out of a home. Those are viewed as negative, but they're necessary at some time. And so we want to stress not just the outputs of making arrests, but what does the actions of the police do in order to impact the overall well-being of the community? As Albert Einstein said it very well, we can't solve problems by using the same kind of thinking that we used when we created them. So problem solving is a core component of community policing and community governance. A problem is best defined by its parts. Number one is identifying crime, disorder, and fear problems. You've got to identify those. Understanding the conditions that give rise to these problems. So why does this occur? Something happens, why does it occur? Developing and implementing long-term solutions tailored to those problems. So after we identify a problem, we look into it, then we develop a solution, and then did that solution that we came up with, did it make a difference? There's a lot of problem-solving models. The one that's most commonly used and that we utilize most is called the SARA model. And that SARA stands for, S is scanning. That's where you take individual related incidents as problems. A problem is something that occurs more than once. And define these problems in more precise and useful terms. So you got to know what it is that you're looking at. What is the issue? And then you have to provide the analysis to it. The information is collected from a variety of sources. It's not just police data, and you use it to illuminate that underlying cause of the problem. And here in the analysis phase, you have to identify the stakeholders, and it isn't just the police. This is something the police cannot do by themselves, because if you want to truly solve a problem, if the police just go in, and I can give you example after example of example of police going in to say, oh, here's a problem, we're going to go in, we're going to take the actions, we're going to decide what's going to do, we're going to make a lot of arrests, and we're going to solve that problem. And then they leave the neighborhood, and what happens? It comes back. The problem comes back. Because the citizens aren't involved. The people who live and work in that neighborhood have to be involved with the solutions, because they're the ones, the police, there's not enough of us. We go, we help the community work and solve a problem, and then we have to leave and go on to another problem. But the community is there, and they're the ones that are there to make sure that that was a long-lasting solution. So we have to identify stakeholders. And stakeholders are a lot of different people and groups. Then your response, when you work with those citizens and business, public and private agencies, the officers, come up with an idea, a program of action that may be used. And it should, in most cases, it should go beyond traditional criminal justice remedies. We're not just going to go and solve a problem by arresting our way out of it. We can't do it. It doesn't work. It's shown to not work. So you got to come up with some unique solutions. And community, when police and community cooperate and speak, you come up with some really unique solutions. And then finally, it's an assessment. Once you've tried, you come up with the solution you think, and you go out and you put it into place, then 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, a year later, review it. Go back, take a look. Did what we do alleviate the problem or solve the problem? If not, let's go back. We maybe don't have the right set of data. Change your way of thinking and make a difference. Change your work. What are some of the advantages of the problem solving? Well, it utilizes the officer expertise and creativity, as well as community expertise and creativity. It promotes a greater community involvement and more resources for a problem. Your information sources expand. There's less of the finger pointing and labeling because everyone is involved in that solution. You're working toward mutual goals. There's positive roles for the people with the problem. The neighborhood who has the problem, or the community who has the problem, has a positive role to come up with a good outcome to solve that problem. And when I said before, it's not a police, crime is not a police problem, it's a community problem. We don't take ownership. The ownership is shared with the community. And solutions are always more effective when developed together in partnership. So what is that partnership? What has it got to include? It's got to include positive relationships with the community. So when there isn't a problem, you have to expect that your staff, my staff, the police, need to be out in the neighborhoods, be out in the community. When there's not problems, getting to know the community, building positive relationships before there's a problem. It's putting those deposits in the bank. Good relationships, building up deposits, because when something negative happens, and it eventually will, you're going to do a mass withdrawal from the bank. So you need to have time. Officers need time to build positive relationships with the community. Community involvement has to be a part of it. That's how we do crime control and prevention. The community has to be involved. It's a pooled approach to address the community members' most urgent concerns. We're going to work together with you to help you solve this community problem. And finally, a shared responsibility for finding those workable solutions that detract from our safety of our community and the quality of life in our communities. There's four keys. Community contact. You can't get to know somebody without contact. And you can't make contact with the community if you never get out of your squad car. So community contact, going to where the community is, at their events, at their neighborhood meetings, having that community contact. Communication is key in anything we do. If you don't communicate what the issues are, what the problems are, communication is how we get to know people. Trust is a huge concern. If we don't have trust of the community, we can't serve. We can't solve the problem, because if the community doesn't trust us, there's no legitimacy. And then information exchange. The better relationship you have with the community, and the community wants a safe, they want a safe neighborhood. They don't want to be fearful. And so every crime that's committed in this country, somebody knows about it. Somebody has information. The key through community policing, community governance, is to have that trust, have that community contact, and build that up so that somebody with information shares that. The snitching thing is no snitching. That's a terrible, terrible thing, problem that we have to work on, because we all want the same thing. We want a safe community. The idea of this, we have a government, we have community, and we have the police. If those circles are not together, if there's no trust, if they're not communicating, they don't interact. The idea is to bring those circles together, and so that line space in the center where all groups collaborate expands. Government and community and police are all and should be all one. The benefits of those collaborative partnerships are that it offers a comprehensive way to address a problem. It increases the coordination among public agencies in the community. It represents the needs of all facets of the community. Everybody has a voice. It establishes a broad base of program support. The legislature and the federal government and a lot of folks, quite frankly, we have to have money to do business, and so this is viewed positively by the funding sources. I tell police chiefs that all the time. And it increases the available information, and for the community, it fosters a feeling that they're not alone. We're in this together. You're not alone. Nobody should ever sit in their home, in the community, and feel that they're alone. So that's an idea of what community policing, community governance is. That's a brief, very brief, what it is. I couldn't make it any shorter, and there's a lot more detail that I'd love to go into. What I'd like to do now is talk to you about a few issues that might be impacting this philosophy and the implementing of it. When I go out and talk to police chiefs, they say, oh, we're doing community policing, no problem. And they do that a lot because it goes back to when President Clinton was president, he created the cops office and money started flowing out of the cops office. Oh, everybody was doing cops. Before that, it was something different. And after that, there's other thing. We go with the best thing in order to try and get money. But there's a lot of agencies who say they're doing community policing, and I'll tell you, they're not. One officer, well, we've got a community policing officer, or I've got a community policing, a five-member team. That's not going to work. Everybody has to be involved. Every one of your staff, sworn and civilian, has to be involved if you're going to truly have community policing. Just saying, we do foot patrol, or I've got a bike patrol, that's not community policing. It might be a part of it, but it's not community policing. Because when you have, I've been a cop for 45 years now, since 1973, so I'm going on 46 years. When you say something like that, that these are the community policing officers, What happens? Oh, they're the ones. That's the grin and wave squad. Those are the folks who out, they're glad handing. They're, you know, being nice and nice with the community. We do the real police work. The rest of them over here, we do the real police. We will answer the 911 calls. And you're creating friction within your organization, and you can't do that. So if everybody isn't involved, you're really not doing community policing. Some will say I was out in Eugene, Oregon, talking to the city manager out there. And their community, they had some issues at the University of Oregon and with the police and in their community, and they said, our community wants community policing, our government, our council and mayor want community policing. And the city manager said, I've been talking to my officers, and they say, my acting chief and the officers, and we need something like 20 or 15 or $20 million to implement community policing. It was some exorbitant number. We need 50 officers and, you know, millions of dollars. And I just told him, you're lying to you. This doesn't cost a dime. The way people think, the way you approach your job doesn't cost a dime. Now, you might spend a little money on training, and if your officers are spending more time on neighborhood problems, then you might need an officer, you know, might help to add another officer or two. But I can tell you, when I was in White Bear Lake, we did a community survey, and we asked the community, if we can give officers more time to spend in the neighborhoods to solve neighborhood problems, would you support that we don't show up right away, maybe later in the day or even tomorrow on a minor nonviolent call like somebody stole the bicycle out of your yard? 95% of the community said yes. We support that if it gives officers time to solve problems. So it's a way of doing business. It doesn't take a lot of money. And the one thing, if you're going to implement community policing, the crime stats may go up initially. And that is because, as I mentioned earlier, less than half the crime that actually occurs in this country is reported. People don't trust the police. People don't, for whatever reason, they don't want to contact government to say that this happened. And so they don't report it. As you build trust, as you implement this philosophy and your officers build relationships and build trust with the community, they'll feel more comfortable approaching an officer and telling them information. And so maybe your crime rates are going to go up. They should eventually go down, but they might go up initially. The current training and education is not good enough. I think all officers, I told you, we trained 24 hours when we implemented this, and I don't know if that's enough. You need to do refreshers and everything else. People think, oh, this is common sense. It is, but sometimes we miss a lot of common sense, and we need to focus on the training and the education within our state and within our profession. Everybody's got to be trained. Higher education doesn't focus on it enough. I have spoken to the largest law enforcement program in higher education in Minnesota every year in senior seminar. And when I talk to those senior students who are getting ready to graduate with a degree in criminal justice, the majority of them have really no clue about what community policing is. They don't understand the philosophy. Now, if we're not teaching it in our universities and our community colleges, then how do we expect officers to do it? Because I can tell you that it doesn't happen in skills much, which is the Minnesota system, skills. I can tell you other states that I've been a chief in their academy training, which is what skills in Minnesota is, it's an academy training, they spent 4 hours on community policing, 5 hours on flashbang grenades. Where is the logic there? We spent 4 hours training our officers that we give the power and the authority that they may have to use deadly force. They have to work with community, and you train them 4 hours? Minnesota might be a little better, but that's still an issue. Post doesn't require it. I'm not a fan necessarily of government mandates, but most of the training, when we send officers out, it doesn't include community policing. And unless the chief or the city manager, you know, or the mayor in a community is visionary enough to demand it, it may not happen. The agencies don't focus enough on it in PTO. A lot of people do FTO, field training. We have implemented PTO training in our city, which is police training officer, and it's problem-oriented. It's based on adult learning principles. It focuses on solving problems. And at the end, before our people graduate from PTO and become an officer to work by themselves before they get off probation, they have to do a neighborhood presentation. It's to the mayor, the mayor's invited, our council, the city manager, all the department heads, the leadership, the public safety. They have to come in, public safety advisory committee, they have to come in and do a neighborhood portfolio, explain, here's my neighborhood, takes them 20 minutes to a half hour, here's my neighborhood, here are the key businesses, here are the key leaders, here, do I have a school, what the problem is, here's the problems that I identified, here's something that I worked on, and they have to lay that all out before we'll even let them pass probation. So we don't focus on it enough in Minnesota, and I think we need to. And it's just not Minnesota, because Minnesota, I will tell you, is probably better than most states. We have more winners and finalists of the IACP Community Policing Award in Minnesota than probably any other state. So we do a lot of good things here, but it's not enough. And we recently lost a great resource, the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute, which was funded by a lot of by government. A lot of departments said, well, we don't have to pay for this. We do not want to pay for training. And so if you don't have government grants to keep something going, I was one of the founders of the Minnesota Community Policing Institute back in the early 90s. There was four chiefs and Jerry Bevere and Trish from the state got together, and we created the Minnesota Community Policing Institute, and that later morphed into the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute, and I'm sad to say that has gone. So, Chair, if I could, I'd like to tell you a little bit about how well this works and how effective it is. In Mankato, we have what's called the Tapestry Project. We have a large Sudanese, Somali, East African community. And this project is built on community policing philosophy of partnerships, problem-solving, outreach. We build trust through interaction. It builds strong community through education, mentorship, and cross-cultural communication. And it fully involves the partnerships where the Department of Public Safety, a housing group in the city, and the Minnesota Council of Churches, and our refugee communities, immigrant communities. They were fully involved as an equal stakeholder. These folks came from, many of them came from refugee camps in Africa, and they didn't understand. They knew, found out 8 hours before they came to Minnesota came to the United States where they were going. So they didn't understand a lot of things. So we focused. Police were the leaders and partners in this effort, but what did we focus on? Health. We talked about the differences between urgent care and emergency room, driving up emergency costs, because people don't have a doctor, so they just go to the emergency room. That drives up health care costs, and there was no preventative care. We talked about parenting. One woman told us, well, my daughter said that if I take my cell phone away from my daughter, that the police would come. The daughter was putting a line over on her mother, and I said, no, that's going to happen. And we actually put on parenting classes at the Department of Public Safety building. Government services, how to access local government, transit, transportation. We brought in businesses to talk about how to start your own business. Housing, there was a lot of landlord and tenant issues. People were getting kicked out of their housing. Many people have never seen washing machines. And then safety. We identified a huge problem of cooking fires, because if you're cooking in a refugee camp over an open fire with a pot of oil to fry something, you can walk away from it and it's not really a problem. But if you walk away from that oven in an apartment building, you're putting your lives and the lives of your fellow tenants in danger. This, you can go to this link. I'm not going to go to it because it's about a 6.5-minute video, but it talks about the Tapestry Project in Mankato and how it brings community together. I would encourage you, if you want to learn more about that, go ahead and do it. Speed issues.
Director, yes. I'm going to interrupt, and I apologize just because the time is getting away from us. You've got some wonderful examples.
Knew we might not get through it, but I wanted you to be able to, at your own leisure, to look through and see how effective this can be in all those areas. So,
thank you for the richness of the many examples. That's obviously one of the big questions I would think most of us would have is, does this work? And, you know, where can you point us to be able to have a real on-the-ground feel for you know, this holistic approach. I do want to, Director, I do want to see if we have a couple of members that have some quick questions and comments. I want to have an opportunity for that. I do want to make an observation that as you walk us through this, your presentation didn't begin necessarily with, let's talk about law enforcement and the police and what they do. It is about this, but you put a much bigger context here and a bigger concept, which is labeled community-oriented governance. And you took great care to make sure we walk through those principles. And then from that flows this concept of community policing. And that was when we first spoke, that really struck me because I wanted to start right with community policing. Nothing wrong with that, but there's a bigger context here in terms of the holistic environment that has to do with the governance, the local governance expectations of everything we do in delivering public service to our people. So I do have Chairman Dean and then Chairman Considine. Representative Dean, yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director, for your presentation today. As I was sitting here, I, of course, think about my community. I represent most of downtown Minneapolis and the southern part of North Minneapolis. And there's often talk about community policing. What does it mean? How does it work? The philosophy that you lay out here, I think, helps me and helps me to sort of enter into larger conversations that I think that need to happen. As I'm sitting here listening, I'm thinking about the culture of policing seems to have changed over the last 40, 50 years. And I'm not a police officer. I haven't, you know, driven a squad, carried a gun to try to make the community safe. I mean, I've read a lot about what past police chiefs have written about some of the things. And I guess I'm curious. It seems in some ways we've gotten to a point where there are some officers that believe it's really best for them if the community fears them. And that seems to set up a very adversarial relationship, which then leads to the community not engaged in, you know, helping report crimes, all those other types of things that we know we need to make that happen. And I guess my question to you, it sounds like training is beginning to shift again in what officers are learning in school and learning in the academy. But I still feel like there are a lot of officers that operate from this notion of if the community is afraid of me, that puts me in a position of power and I can police more effectively. Could you sort of speak to that at all, or do you think I'm just way out there in how I'm talking about this?
No, I think there are officers like that, and I think they have no place in the profession. When something happens, when the Castillo incident happened in Minnesota, I went directly to my officers, and some officer would say, well, we can't go out. Dallas, another incident. We can't go out to the community. And I said, you have to go out to the community. You are not, the community fearing you doesn't do a dang thing for your safety. If you want to work in a safe environment, you get to know your community. We need to double down our efforts when something like this happens, when a bad incident happens. We need to reconnect, spend more time with our community, build more trust. Because, quite frankly, if somebody is out to get an officer, there's somebody else in the community that knows it. And I've had people, my officers have had people come up to them and say, officer, I trust you. You better watch out for somebody. They're after you. So we want officers who have the spirit of service and not the spirit of adventure. And we don't need officers, you know, certainly command presence is necessary in some areas, but fearing, if we have an officer that thinks that it's better for them if the public fears them, they have no place in the profession because we are one with the community. We have to be. That's the only way we're going to have a safe working environment. And that's the only way we can have a safe community. So that is exactly the wrong thing. Now, there's people out there who feel it. And sometimes people get into law enforcement for the right reasons, and then they change after you work with them. You know, if you're arresting a lot of people, you're arresting, you're working with people who are problems, but you never want to not treat somebody you arrest with respect, because it'll come back. That respect will come back. And they're still human beings, even if they just murdered their child. So that's, we need to weed that out of law enforcement. That's not inappropriate.
Thank you.
Chairman Considine, then we have two others after.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to say, first of all, thank you to Todd Miller for coming down here. And he has tried to compress what is normally an eight-hour presentation into a half hour. That's why he was talking so fast. I actually did volunteer on the Tapestry program when I was on the city council. And one of the things that was so amazing was to listen to East African community members come in and go, we were always scared to death of the police, and now through the Tapestry program, we find out they're our friends, and that's who we need to go to. So there have been some real successes in Mankato on this under his leadership. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Considine. Chair Johnson.
Chair Mariani, first of all, I have to say it. I do take exception to what Representative Dean said. I probably shouldn't do this here, but I have to speak up for the vast majority of, I would say 99.999% of law enforcement officers. They're out there doing the job and doing what things are best for the community. Most of them, the vast majority, especially in greater Minnesota, live in their community. They are not out there to be bullies. They're not out there to try to put fear in people's eyes. They're out there doing a job, trying to survive. And here again, I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm tired of the Main Street media criminalizing law enforcement for what they're doing, demoralizing them. It is getting sickening, and it's causing a lot of problems in the law enforcement community to the point now where we have some cities across this country that have no-go zones for law enforcement because it's not safe for them. This needs to stop. But to get on to what I want to continue on, One quick question for Director Miller, and then a couple more comments. You said in your presentation that it's for a little bit the crime rate is going to be going up once this happens. Can you explain why or how long that's going to be going up before it starts actually going down?
Director Miller.
It will generally go up, and in communities across the country that experience that when they fully get this implemented and see the crime rate, only the reported crime goes up. Actual crime does not. And even though the crime rate can go up for a short period of time, if you're really working at it and you're doing a good job, you should see that start to drop after a year, maybe two. But the trust that you build causes more people to report more crime, not more crime occurred. But you will also solve, you'll be more effective because you're going to solve more crime because you get greater information. And then when you see that drop, even when the crime, it looks like crime went up, people, if you do, in the surveys that are done, people feel safer because they know their officers, they trust them, they have contact with them. And so the numbers aren't, that's why I say don't trust all these numbers. I have never taken responsibility in a community when crime went down, because I know I got to take responsibility when crime goes up. It's a community issue. But in a lot of cities, they might see it go up for a year, maybe two, but then it comes right back down.
Professor Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I saw that issue, and I see you still have looking at the crime rate in Mankato, you still have a serious problem you're dealing with. It's a little better in Chicago, but not a lot. I think you have a serious problem down there.
I would beg to differ, but
Director Miller,
are you getting mad?
The crime rates statistics.
Director Miller,
And they were from 2016.
If you look Johnson, at the, if I may ask Director Miller to comment.
If you look at the trends, Mankato is a very safe community. Mankato is a large metropolitan area in southern Minnesota. We are the hub for Medicare or medical care, for education. We have over 25,000 students in our area, for jobs. And so any given weekend, we'll have 100, our official population is 40,000. Any given weekend, we'll have 100 to 125. We probably have about 100,000 people a day coming in to work and for healthcare, et cetera, for schools. So if you look at the numbers over a 10-year span, since I came there in 2010, you'll see numbers have dropped. Numbers can change in an instance. You get one active group. Some of the issues are we report everything that the law requires us to report. Some cities don't. If you have one active group of three people that are breaking into cars one night or burglarizing homes, they can break into 40 cars in one night. We report that as 40 break-ins. Some places will report that as one because it's one group. So you can have an active criminal element that can certainly skew your events. But if you also look for 1 year, we were at 90, almost 95 aggravated assaults in our community. And when we started working on that problem, we took that down to into the 40s, cut it in half. So I think Mankato is a very safe community, and there's a lot of communities like that in Minnesota.
Last question, Lee Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Director Miller, you just brought it. You just walked right into what I was going to be talking about next. Minnesota is vastly different across this state. What happens in downtown Minneapolis, St. Paul, Mankato, which is a large city, especially in the area of the state, is totally different from areas like Cambridge, Browns Valley, International Falls. You have more officers working in your city at one time than the entire number of officers in all my cities and my county combined. Each community is different. Each community does it different. They have to do what's best for them. In greater Minnesota, most of the small towns, just doing our normal jobs is community policing because we know our people. We know who lives there. When I went out patrolling, I could drive by a neighborhood, I could look out there and I could name the 14 kids that were playing in that playground. Drive by 2 hours later, what's Johnny up to? He's up to something, he's missing, because I knew Johnny. That's community policing. But as the legislature, and we're going back to when I was going to training back in the early days of my career, all the training was orientated around large metropolitan areas, and that training was useless for greater Minnesota. We went to the courses because we were required to go to them and have our hours in, but we didn't follow any things that were said because we knew it didn't work in our communities. Yes, does the metro area and the large population areas have some problems they have to deal with? Absolutely. But we have created a bigger problem in the law enforcement community by pushing ideas and issues that work in large areas and push them to areas where they don't work. We need to let the people in their own communities do what works and work with them. Community policing in some areas will work, some areas it won't. One of the issues you were talking about training on community policing. In my area, we don't need the training because we do it every day. Down in Minneapolis and Mankato, you might need to teach your officers how to do it the way you see is the proper way for your community. But a standard, this is how you do it, doesn't work in all of Minnesota because we're so vastly different. Now,
so Johnson,
I will wrap it up here. And the other problem, you wanted to make mandatory training for these. Right now, post board, depending where you fall in your license, is minimum 24, maximum 32 hours of 48 credit hours over a 3-year cycle of their license. We do your 8-hour course. Now we're down to about six to eight hours of training left for an officer that has a passion for something that might take 15 to 20 hours of training credit. The training is expensive. And the last issue that this legislature and some of the have created part of the problem is we no longer let officers have discretion. We've taken officer discretion away. He goes up, he knows Johnny's is borderline, causing a little bit of problem. Yeah, could he write him a ticket? But the officer makes a decision. You know, I'm going to give Johnny a break this time. I'm not going to write him up. I'm not going to document anything in the reports because that's a paper trail. I'm just going to talk to him. I'm going to remember that I gave Johnny this break. And down the road, change Johnny's life. But our policies and procedures in our manuals that have gone from 20 to 30 pages to over 800 pages has gotten to the point where the officer has no discretion. If he doesn't follow what's in that policy manual, that officer gets in trouble. He might be sanctioned in some way, he might be suspended. He might be fired because he gave Johnny a break to help Johnny have a better life. So we really need to look how we treat our officers, how we do them, give them the discretion that they have, that they should have to do what's right. That's how community policing works. And that's what we need to get back to.
Director Miller, there was a lot there, and I'm going to want to keep us moving, but just a few comments, if you will.
Sure. I agree with certainly some of what you said. You made some of my points. Every community is different. Each community is different, and they are free to implement the community policing philosophy how they see fit, because communities by size are different, by neighborhoods are different. My first two police jobs were in department. My first chief's job was three full-time officers, two part-time officers, and two dispatchers. I spent a lot of time in bars. Why did I spend a lot of time in bars? Because across the river from us, there was 40 bars in the city, and they closed at 1 o'clock, and at our bars in Iowa closed at 2. We had three bars. So I didn't have any backup. We had one officer working at a time. We had to practice community policing. I got to know the bartenders, the patrons, because when there was a bar fight, and we had a lot of them, those were the people who backed me up. That was community policing. We solved problems that way. I would say, yes, small towns, small departments have been doing community policing because they live there, they know their people. That's a big part of community policing, but they still need training for it. Training is expensive. That's why we open up a lot of our training to the neighboring communities, small communities around us, and let them train with us. But training is important. I know a lot of officers that get over 200 a year. 48 is required every three. They'll get 100 to 200 hours a year because there's a lot of important things. But community policing is for everybody. It can work in every community. I can show you chiefs in a one-horse town, one-person town, one-officer town that are doing community policing, and they're good at it. And we need to respect that, allow them to do it. And the last thing I will say is policies. If you implement it correctly, policies, departmental policies, and yes, the manuals are ridiculous. That's because of lawyers and everything else. But policies are guidelines. We have an issue with an officer. Is it the right thing? We ask them, ask yourself these questions. Is it the right thing to do for the community? Is it the right thing to do for the agency? Is it legal, ethical, and moral? Is it consistent with our vision, mission, values, and policies? And is it something you're willing to be held accountable for? And if the answer is yes, then just do it. Don't ask for permission. You're not going to get in trouble for it. It's the leadership in the community and in the agency that makes those decisions. I want my people to make decisions. And if you're not making a mistake at some point, you're not a human being. If you have an officer and you don't have something in your file, you probably haven't done a lot in your career. It's important, and discretion. You're right, Representative. Discretion is very important. I have officers given breaks every day because it's important. They're not going to get in trouble for that. Arrest is just one option, and it's not the best one. So if you can save, you can work with that kid, and you can give him a break, and you can develop, you can mentor that kid and develop trust because you know that child, whether it's in a small community or downtown Minneapolis, and you can save and steer that kid, you're mentoring and you're saving a child's life in a lot of cases, that's police work. That's what we want our people to be doing, and you can do it in a town of 1,000, which I started in, or you can do it in Minneapolis, or you can do it in San Diego. It doesn't matter.
Thank you, Director. And I know that part of your presentation was also sharing some experiences that you've observed, not only here in Minnesota, but across the country and indeed across the globe. Members, two quick questions. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be quick. I just maybe to give some reassurance to Representative Johnson, because I didn't see anything in here that feels like a one-size-fits-all, but it seems like it really is more of a philosophy is what I'm picking up. And consistent with that as well, I guess it seems like that it's not aimed so much at individual officers. I mean, because I would agree, my interaction with the officers I work with as a prosecutor is the vast majority are very much thinking of themselves as being connected to the community and addressing concerns there. Because, of course, the great majority of calls that they get are for, I mean, really, when people can't think of who else to call, they end up calling the police. And there's a wide variety of issues they're responding to. I guess how I view this, and would like just a real quick comment from you on this, is it feels like this is as much about having the infrastructure that goes around those officers that, you know, making sure the officer is supported in that work kind of institutionally, that you don't have so much of that traditional approach that is much more narrow and is coming at it from a pretty narrow and focused perspective, instead recognizing that public safety is, as some of the quotes said, is all of our issue. Is that something that you can comment on?
We have excellent officers all across. There's 800,000 officers in the country, and the vast majority of them out there, as the representative said, doing a job trying to make their communities safer. We have some bad apples. Just face it, we're human beings. It happens. But one of the tenets of the community policing, if you're going to implement it and be successful community governance, is organizational change. So you have to have the basis. You have to know that those officers are supported when they're spending a little more time on a call and their supervisor is saying, hey, come on, we got calls backed up. Get out there and do this. No, I'm spending time with this citizen trying to get to the root cause of their solution of their problem, to identify that and to solve it so we don't get called again. If you can spend a little bit more time on one call so it doesn't get repeated, instead of getting called back again and again and again and again, you've actually saved time. So getting that support from the leadership in the police organization, from the mayor, council, city managers, from the leaders in the community, and from every community group takes a lot of effort to do. But if everyone is supported and they all realize this is our community problem, they can solve it.
Thank you, Director Miller. Representative
Dean. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name was evoked, so I feel I need to make a statement here. I said some officers. I have great relationship with lots of peace officers, and the assertions that often get made towards me are misrepresenting what I've actually said. And I'm getting kind of tired of it. And I think that all of us as committee members, we should listen closely to what members say and actually respond to those, and not just what we think we hear, but what's actually stated. Because we've gotten to a point that there seems to be this vilification of people making any negative cops towards police officers. And as was mentioned, as has been mentioned, there are some officers that aren't doing the job that we want them to do. And if we can't call that out, then what are we doing here? In the end, public safety is our final goal here. And if we're not doing those things, if we're not having the dialogue that's going to get us closer to public safety, which, by the way, includes the safety of police officers as well, we're not doing our work. So I just wanted to correct the record. My statement said that some officers, not all officers. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Members, we all acknowledged at the very beginning when we came together that we're going to have some tough conversations and tough sessions, and I want us to embrace that honestly and fully. Obviously, we want to embrace it with a lot of respect for one another. I have to say, Representative Dean, this sort of reminds me a little bit. I've spent 10 years in education, and a number of those years I had teachers beating me up because I was mischaracterized for my comments about certain teaching practices. At the same time, I also fiercely defended their absolute right to be good professionals. And, it comes a little bit with the territory here, I suspect, being part of the legislature. Director Miller. Thank you so much for the gracious commitment of time. You drove up here from Mankato this morning, you and I. I just had a conversation not even a week ago, and so this has been very short notice, and I terribly appreciate your commitment to this legislative body, deliberation with tough issues, but also with issues that come from the field directly. And so I want to thank you for your many years of work. We asked you to come specifically to talk about community policing and to place it within the context of broad public service accountability, and I thought you did that very well today. I appreciate our ability to continue to communicate so you can further advise our work as we go forward.
Chair, thank you for, and members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to come up and talk to you. I've enjoyed it immensely. I'm very passionate about this, and anything that I can do to assist you or to assist the state, the country, the profession in improving our relationships and making our community safer, that's what I'm passionate about, and I enjoy doing so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you again for your service to the public. With that, members, we're going to move to, we did burn up more time than I had expected, and for that I do apologize to my colleagues and to the public. We're going to skip over the Office of Justice Programs. We're going to have House File 301. Thank you, Ms. Weeks, for accommodating us. And so with that, Representative Stevenson and Representative Long, I'm wondering if you could make a motion here, and let's make sure we get these motions correct. All right. So I believe the motion is to move House File 301 to Ways and Means, and our intention is to lay this bill over.
So moved.
Representative Long so moves. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we had a motion for the bill. I also have an author's amendment that
very
I would
well
love for the committee to consider at this time.
Representative Stevenson, would you be so kind as to move the HO3A1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'll move that for him.
The amendment is before us, and this puts the bill in the fashion you wish the bill to be before us. Is that correct?
That's correct. It corrects essentially a typographical error.
Very well.
That Representative Pinto was kind enough to catch for me.
Super. Thank you. Members, you heard the motion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Stevenson, your bill is before us as you wish it to be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The bill before you today, I'd like to explain a little bit as just a way of background, because I'm not sure I introduced myself when I appeared before this committee last week, but in addition to being a freshman member of this body, I'm also a prosecutor for Hennepin County. That's my day job. And this bill is one that arises from my own experiences charging cases in Hennepin County. And I think the best way to explain this bill is by presenting the committee with a fact pattern. I want you to imagine an individual, John Doe, shoplifts a relatively minor amount of goods, say $100, from a Target, and is caught by store security as he attempts to leave the store. Mr. Doe has committed a misdemeanor theft under Minnesota law, which is punishable by up to 90 days in jail and up to a $1,000 fine. In addition, it's likely that Target is going to serve Mr. Doe with a civil trespass notice, telling him that he can't return to that Target store for a period of 1 year. Sometimes the retailers, and I'm not picking on Target here, it could be any, be Walmart or Best Buy, sometimes they'll do all of their locations in the metropolitan area or all of their locations in the state, but usually it's just the one store. Now, suppose that Mr. Doe then returns to that same Target 3 months later and shoplifts again, and this time, let's imagine he shoplifts an even more minor amount of goods, a candy bar, a $2 value, and is caught again as he's leaving the store by store security. You are going to be surprised to learn, might be surprised to learn, that Mr. Doe has not committed another misdemeanor theft. Instead, he's committed felony burglary, which has a statutory maximum sentence of 5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. And for those that aren't aware, it's very rare in Minnesota for people to get the statutory maximum. Under our sentencing guidelines regime, Mr. Doe would be looking at anywhere between a probationary sentence of, you know, 3 years of probation up to 36 months in prison, depending on his criminal history score and the probation practices in the county in which that he committed the offense. So burglary, right? People usually think of burglary as breaking and entering a building, but the burglary statute in Minnesota is much broader than that. It only requires two things, essentially. One is entering a building without consent, and the second is that you have the intent to commit either a felony, a gross misdemeanor, or steal. Okay? Mr. Doe has satisfied both of these elements. The second one's obvious, right? He stole. He stole the candy bar. The first one, he entered a building without consent. The target's open to the public, but not to Mr. Doe, because he had the trespass notice instructing him that he was not to return. He did not have consent. And these cases, which are often colloquially called trespass burglaries, are charged all the time. As a consequence, his misdemeanor behavior has been elevated to a felony. And to my mind, the criminal justice consequences for Mr. Doe are pretty out of step with the behavior exhibited. Right now, across Minnesota, I can tell you that different county attorney's offices are handling this situation differently. So in Hennepin County, the Hennepin County attorney, Mike Freeman, has exercised his prosecutorial discretion and implemented charging guidelines that essentially mean that these cases don't get charged, they get declined, unless the person has some significant criminal history. I'm aware that there are other counties in Minnesota where the cases don't get charged at all. I'm aware that there are other counties in Minnesota where the cases get charged routinely. The result is the behavior is treated very differently across the state, and that law enforcement agencies have some significant confusion about what cases are going to be charged and what cases aren't going to be charged. My bill attempts to solve these problems by adopting a compromise approach. It segregates out these trespass burglaries from the rest of the third-degree burglaries and makes them gross misdemeanors. But it also includes an enhancement that makes it so that the behavior can still be charged as a felony if the defendant has a prior qualifying conviction within the last 5 years. And this is an approach that's similar to what we do presently with our theft statute. Presently, theft is a gross misdemeanor between $500 and $1,000, if the items stolen are between $500 and $1,000, but that is enhanced to a felony if the person has a prior qualifying conviction. So this is meant to parallel what we already do with our theft statute. So if we return to Mr. Doe for a second, if this statute was in effect at the time when he shoplifted from Target the second time, he'd be guilty of burglary in the fourth degree, a gross misdemeanor. That's still a step up from the misdemeanor from the first time that he shoplifted at Target, which I think is appropriate because, you know, he has done something that's a little bit worse. He's gone back to the store that he is not supposed to be at, that he was told not to return to, and again stolen within a year. But it restores some balance to the fact that it's not really, you know, equal to breaking and entering into a business, which is what third-degree burglaries are meant to be. And if he returned to Target a third time after that and shoplifted again while that trespass order was still in effect, he'd then be subject to felony charges, just as was under the current status quo. So that's an explanation of the bill and a rationale for why I am bringing it to the committee today. I think also here to testify is Mr. Ward from the State Public Defender's Office, who'd like to speak a little bit about the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ward. Please give us your name and your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is William Ward. I'm the State Public Defender for Minnesota. For those of you that do not know, the State Public Defender's Office represents individuals who are accused of crime or indigent throughout every 87 counties in our state. For us, that means over 150,000 cases a year. We are honored to represent people who are the criminally accused who've been charged. I'm honored to work with colleagues who work with these individuals daily in this state, but it is a substantial amount of cases that we're talking about. In our role as public defenders in rural counties, Representative Johnson, as well as more urban cities, we trust that we are going to treat people the same way throughout the system. Unfortunately, that's not what happens throughout the system. We, in our positions, see folks who have been basically criminalized because they're poor. We see the criminalization of poverty every single day, along with over-criminalization at the forefront. This bill that Representative Stevenson is talking about is literally the figurative sledgehammer to do a finishing nail's work. At some point, I'm guessing with livability crimes, the amendment or the bill was changed, or the statute was changed, to effectively give people felony convictions for shoplifting a candy bar. The hypothetical Representative Stevenson gave you is not some out-of-this-world example. This is the real deal. I'm sure all of you have seen no trespassing signs in your lifetime, probably within the last week or so, and wonder, well, what the heck does that mean? You have no idea what it means to the poor who are charged with trespassing for loitering in downtown Minneapolis or St. Paul, who are unfortunately suffering from mental illness, and the only way we know how to grapple with that is to call the police, who are dealing with poverty issues every single day due to homelessness and other issues, and they get trespassed. I never heard of that phrase until I worked as the public defender in Hennepin County. This is a trespass case. And then I saw what happens with the trespass case. That same poor individual has now got a felony conviction. So realistically, you all know a conviction of any sort in this state carries a tremendous burden on everything they do or try to do in the future. To add it as a felony conviction, it's a lifetime sentence for being poor. That's really what it comes down to. I support this bill. We've talked before. I wish it went farther, but I understand compromise in the world in which we live. But this is the beginnings of trying to stop penalizing people because they are poor. And I fully support this from my agency.
Thank you, Public Defender Ward. Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Stevenson, I just want to be clear, too. If the amount stolen was, let's say, a television set or an electronic, an iPad or something like that, that person would still be subject to theft charges. This doesn't impact the ability to charge someone with theft. Is that correct?
That is correct. Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, that's correct. You would still be subject to felony theft charges if the amount stolen was over $1,000 or $500 if they had the prior conviction.
Thank you for the clarifying question. Senator Mulder. Lee Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representatives Stevenson. I can't remember if it was last year or the year before we had a bill dealing with shoplifting. I remember Representative Pinto spoke about it. We set it up so if some people might be surprised, especially some of the new people on this committee, that we enhanced the shoplifting, if I'm trying to remember correctly, we enhanced it, I think it's after 25 times they could get an enhanced charge for shoplifting because there's groups going around, it's organized shoplifting. Is this bill trying to deal with that issue, or is this didn't even come up with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I'm aware of that proposal, and this bill is, it fits into the kind of same category. It's not attempting to deal with those serial shoplifters. I will tell you that I have handled cases that are similar to the ones you're describing, and that one of the reasons why I think the compromise position of allowing the enhancement after with the prior conviction or the repeated behavior is important because we do run into those cases where you have misdemeanor behavior that's happening at such a great frequency that it rises to the level that maybe a felony charge would be appropriate. And so the example that I think of when I think of that is I had I remember a gentleman who was stealing a bicycle out of a big box store. Literally once a month, you take the bicycle and go out the back door. And the bicycle was, obviously not the same bicycle, you take a different one every time. But the bicycle itself was worth, $100 or so. And so under our theft statute, we could never get enough incidents in a six-month period in order to aggregate them together to get up to the felony level. But because he had been trespassed, you could get it to the felony level. And so there are situations in which it just keeps happening and happening and happening where it becomes such a difficult situation for the community and for the business that maybe a felony is appropriate. But the overwhelming majority of the cases that I have seen that have been submitted that are trespass burglaries don't involve that much behavior.
Representative Jackson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Stevens. I noticed you had the public defenders here. They were testifying. Unfortunately, I don't, Judge Small is not here right now. I saw him earlier, but I haven't seen him. I'm just, then the small business organizations, I'm just wondering if you've had contact with them on this bill and get there and have any input from them, because some of the stuff we'd like to have everybody's involvement to make sure we get it right and it's favorable for everybody.
Representative Stevens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I have spoken to the County Attorneys Association about this. Their process involves a review period that isn't complete in time for this committee hearing, but it'll be taken up their next meeting, I understand. I've not spoken to a small business group about this bill specifically.
Representative Stevenson, the chair's intent is to lay this bill over, so perhaps I will give you an opportunity to connect with some other stakeholders as well.
I would appreciate that.
Thank you. Representative Lusseau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Stevens, I noticed
Stevenson,
I deeply apologize. Stevenson.
It's fine. I've been called worse.
Not in this committee.
Exactly. So I was just looking at the language here in regards to the exclusions, and I'm just wondering if you could explain why there are exclusions to some types of buildings.
Oh, yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, it's because certain buildings are actually provided in statute as burglary in the second degree. So schools and government institutions, places with pharmacies and banks, they are actually protected by a more severe burglary charge.
Okay, got it.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Religious institutions, yeah.
Yep. Okay, so then one of the requirements that you have in here is that they are told to leave, and I'm just wondering, is that does it matter who is the person in relation to the business that tells them to leave? Could it be any employee? Could it be does it have to be the owner or manager?
Representative Stevens.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So under the current statute, you just have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person didn't have consent to be in the building. What, as a practicing prosecutor, I can tell you that I would never charge a case if there wasn't a signed trespass order so that I could prove that the person had noticed that they were not supposed to be in the building. It is an interesting question about whether you could charge this if you just had a entry-level loss prevention officer at the Target saying to someone, don't come back. Do they not have consent, right? But I will tell you that under existing law, I think most prosecutors would not feel comfortable bringing a case like that, charging a case like that, because there would be significant evidentiary issues.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucero.
What would typically happen, Representative Lucero, is if the person's apprehended in the store, they'd be provided a form to sign off on a form notifying them not to come back. And at some point, that may be that they don't prosecute or call the police on this, but they at least get the trespass notice. Knowing that if it happens in the future, they have a felony that they can charge it.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then I'm wondering, because the language just says if they're told, I'm trying to find the language here right of hand. Told to leave. So I'm inquiring if there's an opportunity here to maybe make that language more tight. Because told to leave and what you just described are obviously two different things.
Indeed. Representative Stevenson.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's a very fair point, and I would be open to revising it, and perhaps as we look to the bill to being laid over, I would look to tighten that up, because I think that, like I said, speaking from my own experience and watching my colleagues in Hennepin County, we wouldn't charge these without a signed trespass notice anyway, and so maybe restricting that further is a good idea.
Super. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your continued indulgence. The next question I have is in regards to on line 1.12, whoever enters a building with the amendment now, it's while it is open to the public. And so the question I have is, what is the definition of open to the public? And let me just provide an example. When I was in high school, worked at a fast food restaurant, and the dining part would close, but the drive-thru was still open.
Yep.
And so.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair.
Members, we're going to move along. because we have another committee.
And Representative Lucero, maybe we can also talk about this after the committee hearing. The House Research did a great dive for me into where the phrase open to the public, and the public has been used in statute. I will tell you that your anecdote about one portion of the building being open, another portion being closed, very commonly results in a burglary charge. So if someone enters a building that is open to the public but then proceeds into an area that is closed, under existing Minnesota case law, that is a burglary.
Very well. Any further questions? Representative O'Neill.
Why don't you go to Representative Lesh?
Oh.
No, it was just...
Chairman Lesh.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. It was mostly tongue-in-cheek. I'm pretty sure that's how Red got into Shawshank. He robbed the wrong place that had a U.S. post office in the same building. So I just wanted to point that out for Representative Lucero.
Chair Lesh, does Shawshank actually exist?
I actually don't know.
I don't know.
This is the corrections committee.
All right. Members of the chair, will then lay over House File 418.
Before you lay it over, Mr. Chair, I have a question real quick.
Boy. All right, slow down, Chair. Chair will lay over House File 301 as amended. And Representative Stevenson, I'm sorry, did you want to?
I did have a quick question.
I thought you were just trying to help me with my amendments. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a really quick question as we're kind of parsing out some of the words, too.
Yeah.
The way you describe the bill and the way I read the bill is slightly different, and I believe that you're trying to narrow it so that you don't have all of these cases that you described as a $2 theft for the second time coming back. But how I read it, because you have paragraph A, paragraph B, now I'm not sure if this is supposed to be an and or an or if there's something missing, but it seems like you have existing language in A, and then you've added B. So I'm not quite sure if you've narrowed it or if you've actually expanded it. So, you know, and I'm not an expert in this, but I couldn't quite grasp what you were actually doing in the language, and it just seems a little confusing. So I don't know if you will confer with some of the nonpartisan staff, maybe.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative, and I appreciate that. What I would point you to is the very opening section, the addition in paragraph A says, except as otherwise provided in this section. Make sure that clarifies to me that B is not an addition, it's a subtraction from A. Because it's saying except as otherwise provided. In other words, you know, you can't, you know, stuff that's in B doesn't count towards A.
Representative O'Neill, you're good? And my apology for blowing past you. I didn't know you had a question. With that, I want to thank Mr. Ward for coming here today for your testimony, for your work. Representative Stevenson, thank you. And the chair lays over House File 301 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And this committee stands adjourned until tomorrow.